I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today on this archive edition of Midday, award-winning author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie joins me for the hour. She is one of the most compelling and gifted writers on the international literary scene today. Her words have been sampled by Beyoncé, her TED Talks have been viewed by millions, and her first novel, Purple Hibiscus, was chosen as this year's One Maryland, One Book selection. Set in Chimamanda's native Nigeria, it's a poignant, unsettling portrait of a family dealing with a multitude of internal and external pressures. We can't take your calls during the show, which first aired in September. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie on writing, on politics, and on stories that bridge cultural divides. That's coming up next on Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you have joined us for Midday. My guest today is the Nigerian author, essayist, and activist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Her first novel, Purple Hibiscus, has been chosen as this year's One Maryland, One Book selection. One Maryland, One Book is a kind of a statewide book club where all of us are encouraged to read a particular book and gather at locations throughout the state, including some meetings with the author, to discuss the novel. So I can tell you that whether or not you choose to attend one of those meetings about this book, I think chances are very good that you will very much enjoy it. It is a compelling story, beautifully told, with characters that are fascinating and complex, and a plot that is unpredictable. I said this the last time that she was here, and I'll say it again. Chimamanda Adichie writes with tremendous power and grace. Her prose is unshakably grounded on a fundament of authority, compassion, and an unquenchable sense of wonder. I came to her work in just the last year or so, and I'm very delighted that I did. Ms. Adichie is the author of two other novels, Half of a Yellow Sun and Americana, which is being made into a film. She published a short story collection in 2009 called The Thing Around Your Neck, and a TED Talk that she gave in 2012 was published as a book called We Should All Be Feminists. Her latest book was published last spring. It's called Dear Ijewele, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions. If you have read Purple Hibiscus or any other of Chimamanda Adichie's novels or essays, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. If you want to follow us on Twitter, that's great, @MiddayTomHall. We are also on Facebook Live, courtesy of WYPR's digital producer, Jamila Kremple. Chimamanda, it's great to see you.
It's good to see you.
We had a great time. I had at least a great time the last time last couple of times we hung out together, so I really appreciate your being here. I've been dying to tell you this for a week. So last Saturday, I'm sitting around, I'm minding my own business. I'm reading your book. I'm in a beautiful park in Georgetown by the canal towpath. My wife was running a marathon, and I was the Sherpa for the marathon, right? So the Sherpa job, when you're helping a woman running a marathon, it comes in fits and starts. You're not occupied the entire time. So I had a little break. I'm sitting there, I'm reading your book, and this guy, this older kind of gruff guy, comes over to me, white guy, I'd say he's in his 70s, says, "What are you reading?" So I show him your book. I said, "This is Purple Hibiscus by this author I really like a lot, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie." And he looks at the cover and he says, "Another book I never heard of." and I mean, of all the things to say, okay, I've never heard of that book. But it dawns on me, literature is a crowded field. I mean, Lord, we get our staff, we probably get 20 books a week just sent to us here at Midday, with authors and their agents saying, please have this on the air. You know, I wonder, for that reader, or for any reader who has yet to come to your work, how do you describe your writing? How do you summarize it, if you will, for a person who hasn't read it yet?
I don't know.
That's fair enough.
I really don't know. And I think it's also a bit difficult to... I kind of wish that all writers needed to do would be to do the writing, not the selling. But increasingly, you have to sing and dance to sell the book. So I really don't know. I think I like to think that my books are different. So I think purple hibiscus for me is many things, but it's about my, I think of it as a kind of romanticized elegy. It's very nostalgic. I wrote it when I started writing it in Connecticut. I had been away from Nigeria for about 3 years, hadn't been back to Nigeria.
But you were a senior in college. I mean, you were young, yes, when you started this book.
I was, well.
And you're still young.
I turned 40 a few days ago. I think young is always relative. So I feel quite old.
Well, we'll talk about that trauma in a minute, maybe.
It wasn't. I mean, I'm hoping that, I'm just hoping that maybe I will be, I won't be identified as often as the young writer. Mm-hmm. People are well-meaning when they say that, but it can also often mean not to be taken that seriously, you know?
Yeah, the still growing up writer. Yeah. Well, your work has certainly been taken seriously by a lot of people. I mean, translated into 30 languages. I mean, it has an international profile.
It does.
And what's it like going back, thinking about Purple Hibiscus? I mean, now you're part of this Maryland One Book thing, which is a great program. It's run by Maryland Humanities. And, you know, so all over the state, you know, in libraries and community halls, people are going to be talking about this book. As you think about it now, because you wrote this in 2003, how does it impress you? It impressed me a lot. I love this novel. I love this. I loved Americana, and I love this novel.
I actually felt almost distant from it for a while because, you know, it's been a while. I've done so many other things. And I went back and I started reading a bit of it a few days ago. And, you know, I thought, actually, not bad. but also it reminded me of some of the subjects that the book is about and the things that I care about. It made me think again of religion because I think it's in many ways about religion. It's about the different forms that religion can take. And also about, and I think this is true particularly for Africa, that form of the colonized religion, the way that religion came with colonialism and how it came with a lot of baggage that had nothing to do with religion. And how that then, I think, corrupted some people's minds, but also made me think about family and nostalgia for home and love. And I think there's an innocence in Purple Hibiscus that I might have lost.
Well, the main character, Kambili, who's a 15-year-old Nigerian girl, you know, navigating this whole complex of family, both her immediate family and cousins and aunts and grandfathers and stuff, and it's Catholicism, the religion Catholicism specifically, is losing any modicum of innocence between when you wrote it and now a terrible thing?
Not necessarily, no. I found myself almost mourning, just having a sort of a fleeting sorrow, thinking about the person I was, the innocence I think that this book is about. But I think that growing up requires a certain loss of innocence. You know, I don't think that one. I mean, I think if you remain terribly innocent when you've grown up, then something's wrong. I think there's a healthy kind of skepticism that we should have. So no, I don't think so. But also, I mean, Catholicism. I think it's about Catholicism. It's also about African traditional religion, and often the clash between the two. But it made me think about how I think about religion now and how I think about Catholicism now. And in some ways, I think I wrote this book at a time when, you know, I still went to Mass every Sunday, but I was deeply questioning. And now I don't go to Mass every Sunday, but I'm not as questioning. There's a kind of acceptance that I have about the way Catholicism works, and maybe kind of a resignation, you know? But also that the things that I've come to see as useful. Now, I think that Catholicism can be a force for good. When I was more questioning, I think it was easier for me to just think that everything was terrible because of all the problems that I saw. And I think my thinking is a lot more nuanced now.
The problems are certainly evident. There's no doubt. But there's also, you know, the accomplishments and the, you know, the moral leadership of the Catholic Church is unquestioned as well, and particularly with this Pope.
I was going to say that I think actually it's this Pope that made me start to rethink. He made me start to see the possibilities.
I was also raised Catholic, and then I left, like so many people did. I returned to church, although I didn't return to a Catholic church. Mm. I returned, of all things, to a Presbyterian church when our daughter became of age to go to Sunday school. Mm. And church life for our daughter, who's now an adult, was very important to her. It was formative growing up, and the youth groups and the community that church provided. You have a young daughter who's, you know, nearly two.
Yes.
I mean, are you rethinking it in light of her?
Yes, actually, we're raising her Catholic, and it was a conscious decision that I made. And so she gets taken to church every Sunday. Most times I'm in bed reading the New York Times, so her father takes her. But
true confessions, yeah.
but it was important to me. I remember thinking it's much more difficult to. I want her to have the choice. I want her to have the choice of faith, and she can always choose to leave it. Right? But I think it's much more difficult to take it on, or not to have been given the choice. And I'm hoping that I can craft the kind of Catholicism that I want her to have. You know, Catholicism that is progressive and you know, aware of social justice issues, that kind of thing, and not the kind of Catholicism that beats people over the head about, you know, abortion and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like your book, like the characters in your book, it's nuanced. It's complicated. It's not all one thing. Mm. I was very taken, perhaps because of my Catholic upbringing and the centrality of the rosary. Mm. When I was a little kid, I went to parochial school until about the seventh grade.
What kind of Catholic? Was it Irish?
Italian
Catholicism.
But very progressive. Mm. Ours was the family that was always, you know, helping out. And my mom and dad were very involved in the church's outreach activities and stuff. So it was always, the church for us was a place that you went to because we were doing things to help the world, you know. Mm. That's what church was to me. And as I got older and I started hearing about stances on abortion or gay people. And I had, as I had friends who were clearly homosexual, but abstinent, you know, not non-sexual, not practicing sex, or whatever the term is, but they're in seminary becoming Catholic priests. And then in the 70s, you know, the church is bashing homosexuality. So the conflicts became difficult for me personally. But the rosary, I did this gig, it was a long time ago, it was 20 years ago. I was in Milwaukee, it was a music gig, and I came back from a rehearsal and I plopped on the bed and I flipped on the TV in the hotel and I stumbled across this network called EWTN. Have you ever heard of this?
Yeah, I know it, yes.
It's the Catholic network. I'd never heard of it before, right? So, and on the TV is some nuns saying the rosary. And I was riveted. There's this older nun.
Was it that woman called Mother Angelica?
I think it is. Yes. I think it was. And I think she's like an owner of the network. And she's sitting, and she's like this sort of tough broad from the Bronx. She was great. And she's like, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. And then it was a two-shot shoot. And so there's the shot on Mother Angelica. And then the next shot was all the little, the younger, much younger nuns. They look like they were teenagers. They could be like in their novitiate. And they go, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for sinners now, the hour of our death, amen. And this went on for an hour. I was riveted. I did not move. I sat there with my coat on the bed watching this thing. Just, there is something just, and for anyone raised Catholic in particular, it's a magnet.
Yes. No, absolutely. I can see myself being in that position.
Yes.
Just watching. And you know, the rosary is, there's something very interesting. I remember when I was growing up, my family, we would say the rosary on weekends together. In my parents' room, all kneeling down around the bed. And there's something about it that's also quite meditative.
Absolutely.
You know, the repetition. And one of the things that I felt drawn to in Catholicism is the drama of it, the rituals. I find that so, just really attractive.
Mm-hmm. And the father in Purple Hibiscus of this family, a boy and a girl, and the mother, Beatrice, when they travel, when they're in the car, they say the rosary.
Yes.
The father's very, very devout Catholic and very involved.
Yes, yes. He is, in addition to other things.
Yeah, he's a very complicated dude.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think he's also one of those people who, I think, I like to think of people like that as people you can use to make the point that there is a difference between righteousness and right. So he's very righteous. But in that righteousness, there's just a very dark, ugly streak. He thinks that he can beat goodness into his children. It also comes, I think, he's a fundamentalist. That's what he is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there is a rift within his family, a distance between him and his father that is premised on traditional African religion and Catholicism. Yeah. And that's not unusual.
No, it's not. Not for that generation, no. His father has refused to convert to Catholicism because his father doesn't see why he should, you know, leave a religion that his ancestors have practiced for centuries. And this man who, you know, like many in my father's generation, so my father was born in 1932, and that's about the time when the first missionaries came to my part of Nigeria. And to be educated, you had to become Christian because, you know, the missionaries brought the schools as well. My father converted, but there are many people in his family who didn't. Fortunately, my father is a very moderate Catholic, I'm happy to say. When this book came out, actually, many people, particularly in Nigeria, were just completely convinced that it was my father.
Right. And horrified, too. Oh, my God, she grew up like that. Yeah, right,
right. So then the people who were just showing me so much sympathy, there was the woman who gave me a hug. And, you know, and I accepted the hug. Hug's always good. But I thought, no, it's not my story.
Yeah.
I think that if it had been my story, I wouldn't be able to write the novel.
Because it's a shocking story and a disconcerting story, to say the least. And I'm going to do my best to not do any spoiler alerts for the folks who haven't had the pleasure of reading the book. We're going to take a little break. We'll have more with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie when we come back from that quick break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are broadcasting Facebook Live. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, the Midday News Wrap, we'll have foreign affairs expert John Pfeffer of the Institute for Policy Studies here with us. And we're going to talk about President Trump's speech at the UN, the situation in North Korea, and other international developments. Kamau High, who's the editor of the Afro newspaper here in Baltimore, will also be here. We're going to talk to Kamau about some of the big domestic stories of this past week. Plus, Vincent Lanchese, the founder and artistic director of the Everyman Theater, will stop by, along with the wonderful actor Bruce Nelson. We're going to talk about Everyman's current production of M. Butterfly, which Vinnie Lanchese directed and in which Bruce Nelson stars. That's all coming up tomorrow. Tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is the MacArthur Award-winning author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She was raised in Nigeria. She splits her time between Nigeria and the U.S., where she has a home in Columbia, Maryland. She has won several prestigious awards, including the Orange Prize and a National Book Critics Circle Award. Her first novel, published back in 2003, is called Purple Hibiscus. It's this year's One Maryland, One Book selection. She'll be appearing at the Baltimore Book Festival in the Literary Salon on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And next week, she'll discuss the book at events in Frederick and Gaithersburg as well. We'll give you details about those events at the end of the show today. To join our conversation with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We're also on Facebook Live at the WYPR Facebook page. One of the things that I thought was just a beautiful decision about this book, Purple Hibiscus, is the structure of it. We start on Palm Sunday. There is a dramatic scene between the father and the son in this family. Then we go way back before that. We go through Easter Sunday and then forward from there to a very dramatic, climactic end. Did you make the, when you talk about, when you think about how to structure your book and how to tell the tale, did you make that decision as you wrote it, or did you make it when you were finished?
As I wrote it. Mm-hmm. So I wrote it as it is in the book, which I think was useful for me because there's a sense in which the discovering as you go along, it just helps me. I think if I had written it and then decided to move the structure around, I think it would have been a different book. I think that writing it as it is, and for me, the joy of writing fiction is the discovery. I mean, and so writing about something dramatic that happens and then going back to kind of give context to it, I think, in some ways, even the going back is shaped by that dramatic thing that first happened. So I find that as a writer, it keeps me going. It's a reason to keep going.
Yeah. Years ago, I interviewed E.L. Doctorow. Mm. Terrific.
He was such a lovely man.
He was a lovely man.
I met him in Italy, and he was just the loveliest man. And I thought to be such a lovely man and to produce such wonderful work, I love Ragtime. But
yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
I needed to have that.
Me too. And he is, indeed, he was a delight to speak to. He had just published a book of essays about writing. Mm. We called it Creationists. And he said something that stuck with me. He said, stories propose that life is something of moral consequence. Stories are how we communicate with each other. Stories, and they propose that life is something of moral consequence. And I was put in mind of that statement because the moral consequences of the actions of the father, of his sister, of his daughters, of his daughter, his wife, his son. I mean, the moral consequences are extremely significant to all of their lives. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, what do you make of that observation? Is there a moral, is there any instance in which there isn't a moral dimension?
That's actually very interesting, because I was just thinking, but life, the choices that we make in life, I think, are of moral consequence. I think what stories do, I think life is haphazard and life is messy. And I think stories try to kind of form some sort of shape of the messiness of life. And so life in its messiness does have moral consequences. But because the story distills and tries to create some sort of shape and form, I think the moral consequences then become even more apparent, maybe. But I do think so. I think that our choices, and I'm very interested as a writer in that idea of, and not morality in the simple sense, but just what our actions mean, the choices that we make and the choices that we don't make. Right? I'm always interested in that.
Yeah, the ones we punt.
Yes.
Yeah.
The paths we don't take.
Yeah. Americana is a book that is massive in its scope. I mean, just the locations. I mean, we're in Nigeria, we're in London, we're in New York, we're in New Haven, we're in Princeton, New Jersey, we're in Boston, we're all these different places. This book takes place essentially in two cities in Nigeria, both of which you have personal experience.
Yes.
One is Enugu and the other is Nsukka, Nsukka being the place where the University of Nigeria is located. The father in this book, his sister is a professor at the university. So you go back between these two places, and it's kind of, they're like Venus and Mars too for the children who are going back and forth between being with their family and being with their cousins.
Yes.
The fact that the radius of this book is considerably smaller, although there's a whole bunch of characters, the radius is smaller. Do you think that was, how much does that inform, you know, how these people develop?
Mm. That's interesting. I think it does. It must. We're shaped by where we are, aren't we? I also think that it's also about where I was as a person at the time. I didn't know, I'd been in the US for 3 years, of course, but I didn't quite know America. And before I left Nigeria, most of my life was in Nsukka, which is the university town where I grew up. And so in some ways, I think it was writing what I know. As a writing teacher, I say to my students that people often say, write what you know. But actually what I say to them is, don't write what you don't know, which I think is slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
And so
don't write what you don't know. Yeah.
So I think it was me doing that with Purple Hibiscus. But also it's that Nsukka is a town I love very much. And I wanted very much, and I was so homesick when I wrote this book. And so I just wanted to remember. I wanted to remember the flowers because, you know, I grew up in a house that was surrounded by flowers and roses and hibiscuses. And we had this lovely high hedge of whistling pine. And I wanted to remember that. So I think having that kind of focus on place, I think place is even a character in this novel.
Yeah.
Because of how much I wanted to remember. And to remember also that sense of a university community that's in slow decline because of the consequences of a government that just had decided to neglect education. And so that idea of wanting to capture that kind of something quite sad, but also beautiful in its sadness.
Jill writes in on Facebook Live, I read half of A Yellow Sun and was so moved by your characters and your characterization of the expats and nuances of economic classes. She asks, do you know what you're going to write before you start writing?
No.
Yeah. So what you're talking about, write what you know, but also don't write. You know what you don't write. You know what you're not going to write.
Yes.
But as exactly. For what you're going to write, yeah, maybe not so much. Yeah. Yeah.
But in general, I'm not the sort of writer who has a summary and who sort of has summarized plots and which, you know, I think works for some people, but not for me, because I need to have a sense of discovery and wonder. And so I have a general sense of what I want to do. But when I start, often characters will do things I didn't plan to have them do. And things I didn't necessarily think would happen just happen. I mean, it's always difficult to talk about this with people who are not familiar with writing because they look at you like you must be mad.
Right.
How can you possibly say that?
Of course.
Yeah, but it's true. It's what happens.
Do you have to rely on actual people as general models for your characters, or do you find yourself, you know, just able to completely concoct out of thin air a person and his or her personality?
I like to think I can make people up. I love to play God. I mean, one of the things I want to be God. And in many ways, I'm the God of my characters, which is rather exhilarating. But no, I think it's somewhere in between, which is that I'm a person who watches the world very carefully, and I watch people, and I notice things, and I write things down. But on the other hand, I don't think I ever base characters entirely on a person. So it's I think a mix of both. So I'll take things from people, and then I'll add things to it, and mix things up, and create a character. But what happens often is that friends of mine will say to me, "Oh, I know that's me. Oh, I know who you base that on." And often they're wrong. Yeah. I'll say, actually, it's the other person that I based it on.
Yeah. That power of observation is stunning. I mean, it's stunning. We have Erica writes in from Facebook, again on Facebook Live, and says, I usually don't reread novels, but I made an exception with Americana. Mm. Now, that's a book you wrote like 4 years ago, 10 years after this one, Purple Hibiscus, that's the Marilyn One book. She says, what a well-crafted story. I think I could even read it again. It was so real. I still think about Ifemelu, who is one of the characters in Americana. And Erica, if you haven't read Purple Hibiscus, you should, and then you will find yourself thinking about Ifeoma, another, the aunt in this story.
Yes, yes.
That's a name your mother shares,
yes.
Right? So you sort of stole the name. But
it's also a fairly common name,
I
should say.
And she's a university professor, and your mother and father worked at the university. So,
yes.
But your powers of observation really are staying. I stumbled across this little short story that you just published in Harper's Bazaar in London a few weeks ago. Here's a little paragraph. Forgive me. I'm going to read some of your writing to you as you sit right here, which is probably a horrible thing. It's like when I go to dinner parties and people put on CDs that I did, I hate that, you know. So with your apologies and indulgence, I'm going to do this. But you and your boyfriend or husband are on a train.
Yeah,
or
character.
Not you, the character. Excuse me. The character. That's right. The character and the husband on a train. And the woman encounters this other couple that gets on the train. And then you, or this woman, you as the writer, invent what they're all about. And we all do this. We see these people on a train or in a cafe someplace, and we say, oh, I bet they do this, and I bet they do that. I bet they live here. So here's what you write about them partially. Both their hands were below the table. Were they holding hands? They seemed like people who truly felt things, who touched their emotions. Their lives were lit by an inner incandescence. I try to imagine their home, full of color, intense flowers in asymmetrical vases, unapologetic paintings, perhaps leaning rather than hung on the walls. Gosh, I love that. Perhaps leaning instead of hung on the walls. It's that specificity of the imagination and that crafting of the thing. So you can immediately imagine their house or their apartment. So is that, you know, the fifth draft, the ninth draft, the 12th draft, or is that the thing you just rip off and say, oh, I gotta get this darn thing out to Harper's tomorrow?
Oh, I just threw it out as I was, you know, I was making cereal in the morning. Yeah. And I have to thank you for noticing, because I think when you write, you hope that the things that matter to you will matter to the reader. And it's details like that that matter to me. And thank you to Erica, by the way. And please reread it again.
Yeah, why not?
But with that story, I think I was actually kind of stressed because I had said yes to Harper's Bazaar, and it was, I don't know, a few days before I was handed in and I had nothing. And so I kind of wrote it from panic. But also I remember that I had been thinking about that idea of the lives we haven't led and how we project those things on other people and how we're often wrong, right? I mean, I think the crude way to put it would be to think that the grass is always greener, somebody else's garden. But also just that sense of you've been with somebody for a while in a marriage or in a partnership, and at some point you start to think, well, what if it was someone else? You know, what if I... And I wanted to try and capture that. And I also wanted to give it a kind of hopeful ending, because increasingly I'm very thirsty for hope.
Yeah. Boy, that's for sure. That's for sure. Joyce Carol Oates talked about the editing process, mm-hmm. where she had to cut things out of things that she had written, and she referred to the cuts as my little darlings. Mm-hmm. You know, we mm-hmm. do get attached mm-hmm. when we're writing. Mm-hmm. We do get attached, mm-hmm. but then we realize that it's better without the little darlings.
Yep, you have to kill them.
Yeah. How is that process for you? I mean, is it a lengthy, laborious, and mm-hmm. troubling process?
It is, but also for me a necessary thing. I'm actually quite clear-eyed and ruthless when I take things out, and I console myself by telling myself I can always use it another time or with something else. So I'll cut things and I'll save them. So I have a file of cut out things, killed, mm-hmm. murdered darlings.
I do too, just in case.
Yes.
Just the next speech, I maybe just throw them in there, that next essay. Oh, that's good to know. That's good to know. Maybe one day I'll grow up and be a writer. That would be fun. All right, we got to take a little break now. The novelist and essayist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is my guest. Her latest book is called Dear Ijewele, or A Feminist Manifesto in 15 Suggestions. That was published last spring. She's also the author of We Should All Be Feminists, based on a very popular TED Talk she delivered in 2012. Her novels include Americana and Purple Hibiscus. That's the one we're talking about mostly today. That's the One Maryland, One Book selection this year. We'll have more with Chimamanda when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the novelist, essayist, and activist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Her first novel, Purple Hibiscus, is set in Nigeria, where she was raised. It's about a family that is navigating both internal and external conflicts. It's a coming-of-age story, a story about the ties that bind, and an exploration into the terrifying realm of abuse. She'll be appearing at the Baltimore Book Festival on Sunday afternoon, as well as in events in Prince Frederick and Gaithersburg next week as part of the One Maryland, One Book program. That's an initiative of Maryland Humanities. Her first novel was published in 2003. It's called Purple Hibiscus, as I said. And by the way, I misspoke earlier in the program where I said she'd be appearing in Frederick. It's Prince Frederick, Maryland. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. And thanks to our good buddy, Jemila Kremple. We are also on Facebook live. Is it fair of me, accurate of me, to refer to you as a novelist, essayist, and activist? Do you think of yourself as an activist?
No, it's interesting you asked me that. It's interesting you asked me that because I just was thinking about that and I thought activist sounds so not me. I would not describe myself as an activist.
See, I'm asking for forgiveness rather than permission because I already said it. But yeah, but I mean, because you are very much associated with feminist causes, mm. With your writing about feminism.
I just feel that activists kind of just, it feels very big and it feels that one has to kind of be above board and very good and very worthy. And I'm not, and I don't want to be.
You would never want to be in the opposite camp of those who are underboard. And
so there's something, you know, there's just something about activists that feels, I like to think that I'm a storyteller. I'm a person who I think has been blessed with a gift that enables me to create. And that's primarily how I think of myself. But I'm also, you know, on the other hand, this person who gets very angry about certain things and speaks out about them.
Sure.
And
give us an update on what's going on with the lost children, the so-called the girls, the Boko Haram kidnapped, the Chibok girls. Just in the spring, in May, Boko Haram released 82 of them. They originally began by kidnapping 276 of these children some years ago. So what's the latest on them?
I just never trust the news about this. And one of the reasons I found myself staying away from talking about it a lot is that it kind of became this sort of celebrated thing in the West. And I think it made Boko Haram seem, it kind of became the African Taliban that targeting girls. And I don't think Boko Haram is necessarily any more sexist and misogynistic than sort of the mainstream population in northern Nigeria, right? I mean, there's a lot of child marriage. Girls just have a very difficult time in northern Nigeria. So apparently the girls who were released, they were said to have been held by the government because the government was re-educating them and they hadn't been allowed to see their family. The thing for me about reading news of this sort is I just never trust it. I just feel that there are things that we
aren't told. It's tough to find a credible source.
Yeah.
I want to play for you, if you wouldn't mind, a clip of the president yesterday. He, of course, addressed the UN earlier in the week. And this is something he had to say about Africa yesterday.
Africa has tremendous business potential. I have so many friends going to your countries, trying to get rich. I congratulate you. They're spending a lot of money. But it does. It has a tremendous business potential and representing huge amounts of different markets. And for American firms, it's really become a place that they have to go, that they want to go.
So he's addressing leaders of African countries, at the UN, and this is in the beginning of his speech. So his go-to default instinct is to talk about how everyone can come to Africa and get rich. It's, to my ears, yet another shocking, and to many people's ears, you know, just a shocking example of tone deafness on the part of our president. How do you hear that?
I mean, two things. I actually was struck by his saying, I congratulate you. So I congratulate you that my friends are going to get rich in your countries. Just seems a very odd thing. The second thing is that he's not entirely wrong. And there are many people on the continent of Africa who actually want things of the sort to be said, which is that international
companies... It's a good place to invest and all that.
But, I mean, not in the way that he said it. He sort of gave it a very rosy patina, right? So my people are going there to get rich and I congratulate you. But actually, maybe we should be talking about what international corporations do on that continent and whether they follow the same rules that they do in other parts of the world and, you know, what they do to their profits. I think we should talk about that because often the conversation about Africa is one of of pity. So we talk about there's so much poverty, which there is, right? But it somehow becomes the only thing that we talk about. And often it becomes difficult to see that that there's a lot more going on. And that, like he said, I'm sure that his friends are going there. They're probably not going there wearing the same the kind of ethical hat that they would wear if they were doing business in other parts of the world. And we should talk about that. And I don't necessarily think that he's saying congratulations to African leaders because his friends are going to Africa to get rich is a very useful thing. I mean, how does that...
And in the context of the history of colonization of countries in Africa, it's something, because now that was colonization by state entities, and this could very well become colonization by corporate entities.
Yeah, and it's one thing, yes, but it's one thing to talk about, because, you know, many of these African countries want... I mean, there's a lot of talk about wanting investment, but for me, it's a question of investment on what terms. And I'm not interested in the Americans going to African countries to get rich. I'm interested in the opportunities that Africans themselves have to conduct, their businesses and whether they have access to capital and that sort of thing. But you know what, though? I mean, this country's president, it's still very difficult for me to say his name. It's not that surprising. I mean, I think that when you think about all the other things that he has said, this is kind of mild. It really is.
There's that.
And also, I think it's part of a larger tradition of the way that America talks to Africa. I mean, it's part of a larger tradition of a certain kind of patronizing tone. You know, it's kind of Africa. It's in the words of this Englishman who I think is said to have said this in... I'm probably going to be wrong about this, but maybe he said this in Kenya. But he said, the African is my brother, but he's my junior brother. So there's a sense in which the tone in which American leaders talk about and to Africa is the same. And that, I think, is what needs to change. It's that tone that needs to change.
The piece in the Nation magazine just a bit ago that talks about DACA and its particular effect on Africans. That black immigrants are deported and detained at disproportionate rates from other immigrants from other countries. African immigrants are among the most educated, but have among the highest unemployment rates here in the United States. The characters in both Purple Hibiscus and Americana are educated. They're professional. They're successful. In a couple of cases, they're extremely wealthy. But the immigrant experience for many people, even people with medical degrees and law degrees coming to the United States, is particularly difficult.
That's interesting. They're among the most unemployed
immigrants? According to the Nation magazine.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, underemployed, I might agree. But unemployed, that seems... that is surprising.
I was surprised by that as well. Yeah. And I haven't checked it out anything more than having read it in the Nation magazine.
But it doesn't surprise me that about there being more likely to be deported. You know what? Black people just it seems like the...
Yeah, it's a double whammy.
You've
got to deal with being black and all that entails. And then, by the way, they don't have papers.
I mean, I think that it just seems to me that the worst part of every deal is what black people in general get in this country.
Blair Stokes writes in on Facebook Live, I learned to make jollof rice after reading half of A Yellow Sun, and one of the most beautifully... He says it's one of the most beautifully written books I've ever read. Half of Yellow Sun is the one that I'm saving for myself. That's the only one of yours I haven't read yet, so I'm really looking forward to being able to do that. We are talking a little bit about Purple Hibiscus. It's the Maryland One Book selection for this year with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I was also taken reading this book and then after reading it, finding out how young you were when you started it and wrote it. You weren't famous then. You weren't a celebrity. You weren't on television. You weren't being, asked to give commencement addresses at prestigious colleges. You and I did a gig together at the City Lit Festival in April. you know, in front of a large audience that had, you know, scooped up the tickets to this thing well in advance. They wanted to see you. They wanted to come and see you. And I will never forget this line of people when they invited people to come up and ask questions. This long line, many young women of color standing all the way back to the end of the auditorium waiting to talk to you. And when they got to the microphone, the passion, the gratitude, the enthusiasm for you as a person and your work in general was palpable and very touching and moving to me. You're writing books now as a celebrity, as opposed to Purple Hibiscus when you were writing as one of those quote-unquote young writers. Is it different? Do you feel a different sort of pressure or a different sort of, you know, notion about how things will be received?
That's actually a very good question, and I think I should ask myself that a bit more. I also was quite moved by that event. I'm always, usually at my events, I like to joke and say that usually the first two or three rows of seats are occupied by just incredible-looking, fierce young Black women. And my manager jokingly calls them your Afro girls. And so I like to, whenever I sit at an event and I look out and I see my Afro girls and I go like, yes! So, but also just, you know, and increasingly now I think there's, I think with Americana, I remember doing an event and I was struck by just the diversity of the audience, which I find quite moving because there's a deep part of me that just longs for, you know, that thing that people say when you're in a beauty pageant and you're asked, what do you wish for? And you say, world peace.
World peace, right.
But there's a part of me that deeply longs for that. I mean, just the simple kind of coming together of people. So anyway,
you could long for worse, let me tell you.
but I like to think that I don't think about reception when I'm writing because the writing process is still deeply personal and deeply... In some ways, because the things I felt when I was writing 15 years ago are still the same. I still feel exhilaration when I think it's going well. I still get depressed when it's not. I still feel a kind of anxious anticipation. It's still the same. I think afterwards, it's different now. I mean, so when the writing is done and I sort of know something is coming out, I kind of know that, for example, you know, people will read it. When I was writing Purple Hibiscus, I thought maybe 10 people would read it.
Yeah, you had no idea.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah. And that 7 would be related to me. So there were three kind people who... but now I know that it's... I'm aware of having a readership. And I don't think it affects the way I write yet. But it certainly affects the way I sort of think, all right, it's out there in the world. I'm just going to step back. Because you cannot control how people read what you do.
No. Nope.
And so it's the stepping back that I think I'm working on still, the kind of letting go. So I you know, I don't read reviews, I don't read things about myself. It's a kind of just leave it alone.
Yeah, and it's a lot harder to step back when you have the kind of profile that you have, but stepping back is still a big part of the process. It is so great to see you. So great to talk to you about this terrific book. It's really terrific. So thank you so much and have a good time this weekend.
Thank you.
Okay. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She's the author of 3 novels, the first of which, Purple Hibiscus, was this year's One Maryland, One Book selection. We spoke in September just before her appearance at the Baltimore Book Festival. Other featured authors this year included Michael Eric Dyson, Devin Allen, Rafael Alvarez, and Rabia Chowdhury, to name just a few. That's it for this archive edition of Midday. Coming up tomorrow, another conversation with another acclaimed author. Elizabeth Strout won the Pulitzer Prize for her 2009 classic Olive Kittredge. We'll share with you a conversation I had with Elizabeth Strout about her 2 latest novels, My Name is Lucy Barton and Anything is Possible. And looking ahead to Thursday, an acclaimed author who lives here in Maryland, National Book Award winner Alice McDermott joins me. Her latest novel was one of my favorite books of the year. It's called The Ninth Hour. We talked about it in October, and we'll rebroadcast that conversation Thursday here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.